Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. It is perhaps not a surprise. It is still stunning to look around and see the number of people who are saying this is a historic shift. What Donald Trump has said and done in the last 24 hours about a Ukraine-Russia peace deal, how all this presages a huge change, not just for Ukraine, but for the whole of Europe and the way we think about big power politics. Some say these changes are comparable to events leading up to and then the aftermath of World War II. Kaya Kallas is the European Union's foreign policy chief, and what she had to say today in Brussels sounded like a strongly worded retort to any idea of Washington and Moscow foisting a peace deal on Ukraine or Europe.
It is clear that any deal behind our backs will not work. Any agreement will need also Ukraine and Europe being part of it. And this is clear that appeasement also always fails.
That word appeasement is hugely loaded, redolent as it is of the failed attempt ahead of World War II to contain Hitler's continental ambitions. Meanwhile, also in Brussels, there's been strong language from the US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth aimed at the European partners of the decades-old transatlantic security alliance, NATO.
After World War II, Eisenhower was one of NATO's strongest supporters. However, by the end of Eisenhower's presidency, even he was concerned that Europe was not shouldering enough of its own defense, nearly making, in Eisenhower's words, quote, a sucker out of Uncle Sam. This administration believes in alliances. But make no mistake, President Trump will not allow anyone to turn Uncle Sam into Uncle Sucker.
Tough language all round at the NATO defense ministers' meeting. The BBC's Jonathan Beale has spent the day there. Beyond that tough language, has there been any further detail on what possible peace negotiations might involve?
Little detail, I think, apart from setting out the parameters as far as Ukraine is concerned. That is that Ukraine will not get membership of the NATO alliance, at least in the near term, that it can't expect to get back all the territories it's lost, and also that the US is not going to be a security guarantee in terms of putting boots on the ground to police any ceasefire if there is one. So the interesting thing is, when it comes to Russia, there has been no such preconditions. And I think the big concern here at NATO headquarters is that essentially the alliance, which has been united, has been sidelined, and the biggest player is calling the shots and expecting everybody to follow. And also the fact that Ukraine has not yet been directly involved in these negotiations. And of course, that much harsher criticism, both from the German defence minister, but also from the EU foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, who say that essentially the Trump administration has begun these negotiations by already making concessions to Moscow. And in the view of Kaya Kallas, that amounts to appeasement.
Yeah, it was strikingly strong language from her. I'm interested to know, is there a feeling that, you know, these other NATO member states, that they're pushing back against what the Trump administration is trying to do? Or is there a sense of, look, we've got to try and embrace them even closer?
I think it's the latter. I think there is, you know, let's be honest, it's not the first time that an American president has accused European allies of essentially freeloading. They acknowledge that, and they see that as saying, certainly as far as the head of NATO, Mark Rutte, is concerned, Europe's got to do more, we've got to spend more on defence, as a way of building bridges with the Trump administration, not being completely alienated. But the figures that Pete Hegseth mentioned today, that Donald Trump has mentioned, that they should be spending 5%, well, let's be honest, the US doesn't spend 5% of its national income, GDP, on defence, and I think very few European countries will be able to do that. There is a promise to do more, but we'll have to wait and see as to what exactly they can do.
The BBC's defence correspondent Jonathan Beale in Brussels. If, as many are saying, this is a major shake-up to Ukraine's prospects and the whole security framework for Europe, what should be the response of Europe's major defence powers? Sir Richard Shirriff was the former Deputy Supreme Ally Commander of NATO. We'll get on to those bigger questions in a moment. But first, what does he make of the last 24 hours?
Well, I think no surprise, because ever since Trump came back to the White House, all the messages coming out have been that Europe has got to do more, that a peace treaty of some or settlement will be imposed on Ukraine, and that America is now America only, not America first.
Imposed on Ukraine. I mean, that's you think it's likely that, despite the fact just within the last few minutes, Donald Trump has been asked about this in the Oval Office by reporters, and he said, of course, Ukraine will be involved, other people will be involved. Do you think that is going to be a bit part player?
But a bit part player. And the fact that that Trump goes over the head of Ukraine, over the head of NATO, direct to Putin, an indicted war criminal and architect of the most appalling atrocities in Ukraine, and believes that Putin believes in peace. The naivety of it is staggering. And the fact that, again, there's past form here. This is a reflection of Trump doing a deal with the Taliban back in 2020, which presaged the collapse of the mission in 2021. So I think no illusions. And I think the message, loud and clear, is that number one is that America cannot be trusted in any way as an ally, despite what we heard Hegseth saying about America believing in alliances. No, America believes in itself and itself alone. And so the so what is that Europe and Canada have got to stand up together, make it clear that they're not prepared in exactly the way that Kaja Kallas, and it's great to hear a European leader talking so boldly about that. And we've also heard our own John Healey stating unequivocally that we will continue to support Ukraine. And that needs to come from the whole of Europe.
Understood. And I hear what you're saying in terms of sort of the words that are expressed. But the brutal truth is that Europe does rely hugely on the US as part of its security framework. And it is very difficult to see how, I mean, even in terms of just the narrow business of policing a putative Ukraine-Russia peace deal, how Europe could do that without American support in terms of air defense and logistics and the rest of it.
Absolutely. Of course it is. But now is the time to translate words into action this day, as Churchill would have said, and recognize that we can't, that America is not going to be part of the equation. So we stand alone with Ukraine, and we've got to find the means, the will, the determination, the courage, and the resources to make it happen. Now, Europe is rich. Europe needs to make sacrifices in order to provide the necessary support to Ukraine and to give Ukraine the means to stop the Russians in their tracks. And if Europe really pulled together, it's not going to happen overnight, but if Europe really pulled together under bold leadership, it could do so. And we've got to just recognize that America is no longer part of the equation. And there's no alternative but to do, as I say, to stand together as Europe with Canada and Ukraine to do what needs to be done.
Sir Richard Shirriff, former Deputy Supreme Ally Commander of NATO. As we heard from him and others, there's a widely held view that Ukraine has been weakened by the contacts and the comments out of Washington. So what hand can Ukraine play now? What cards does it still hold? Maria Avdieva is a Kyiv-based security analyst with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. First, what has been the reaction in Ukraine to Donald Trump's phone call with Vladimir Putin?
Ukrainians were shocked after they heard yesterday how easily Trump's administration is giving out to Putin everything he has stated, especially no NATO membership and leaving Russia the territories it currently occupies. Ukrainians were preparing that there will be some concessions, but hearing it openly, this came as a shock. Another scene is that Ukrainians were all the time asking for guarantees that Russia will not attack Ukraine again in a year or later. And then now we see that the Trump administration is kind of putting all kinds of obligations on the European countries, but Europe alone cannot support Ukraine to full extent.
I just wonder whether you think there are still cards in Mr. Zelensky's hand that he can play.
First of all, throughout these 3 years, Ukraine has developed one of the most capable armies in the world. The Ukrainian army was successfully holding back Russian offensive for all this time, but also developing own capabilities. Ukrainian deep strike drones almost every night hit Russian military logistics inside Russia. Ukraine has developed own weapons, and generally Ukrainian army is just on the completely other level now, and also thanks to the partners that has helped Ukraine to train the soldiers and to develop new capabilities. Ukrainians showed to all the world this incredible resilience and resistance, and this is what stays in Ukraine and inside people here. Putin was not able to break down Ukraine. Still, Ukrainians are ready to continue fighting.
I mean, are you absolutely convinced that the majority opinion in Ukraine is that?
No one is saying that currently Ukraine has capacities to deoccupy all the territories. People in Ukraine want that if we now make a deal, we say that this is our territory, we cannot get it back now, we will get it back when we are ready, but we want to know that at this meantime, Russia will not be preparing more troops to attack Ukraine again. And for this, we need to have some strict guarantees.
One of the things that Donald Trump referred to was the need for there perhaps to be elections in Ukraine before a peace deal could be signed. How far do you think that that could possibly shake things up?
This point about elections was brought up by Russia numerous times, and it's very sad to see how the American administration is kind of repeating Russian propaganda narratives. Elections in the current situation in Ukraine are not possible because elections have to be free and fair, and you cannot have fair and free elections when there is an ongoing war and when there are like 900,000 soldiers in Ukraine. Ukrainian army currently fighting Russian invasion and millions abroad. So Ukraine is not prepared to have these elections at the moment, and then people living in the occupied areas. So what we will tell them? Do we not count their voices anymore?
Maria Avdyeva, a security analyst, speaking to me from Kyiv. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, how the hard-right anti-immigration German party, the AfD, is extending its appeal across voting groups in the run-up to next week's elections.
Germany will be better than now. This is my my hope. Familien sind nicht geschützt, man kann nicht mehr auf die Straße gehen.
You can't go out at night on the streets anymore. Migration needs to be more controlled.
Klar definiert sein.
I think we speak about the problems for the young people. A lot of young people have problems with immigrants and criminality.
That report coming up in about 30 minutes. Main headline this hour, the head of NATO has appealed for the West to stay united as a rift opens up between Europe and the United States on peace negotiations over Ukraine. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. Hamas has today said it is committed to implementing the Gaza ceasefire deal with Israel, and it will continue to release hostages as scheduled on Saturday, raising hopes that a resumption of the war can still be averted, despite fears that the current arrangements are on the point of collapse. At the same time, further testimony has emerged from those held inside Gaza. The parents of the young women hostages recently freed have told the BBC of their treatment during 15 months of captivity and the ways they survived. Alice Cuddy has this report from Jerusalem.
It was a nightmare, they warned of, but no one seemed to have listened. In a video filmed by Hamas and later released by the hostage families, you can hear the women pleading in English. the last remaining female observers, the soldiers who watched Gaza's border, were released in the first weeks of the ceasefire, after more than 15 months in captivity. Now home with their families.
And the feeling was that I will take care of you now. I will take care of you now, and everything will be okay. Now daddy's here, and that's all. Everything was quiet.
Yoni Levy's 20-year-old daughter Nama started at the Nahal Oz military base just the day before October 7th. In captivity, held for long periods without sunlight, he says she heard him calling for her release.
She heard me talking on the TV. She saw her pictures, and it's given her a lot of hope. Everybody's fighting for her, for her release. Nobody forgot her, and we'll do whatever we need to take her out of this hell.
For more than a year, the families have prayed for the return of their loved ones. The childhood sweetheart of one of the observers, Daniela Gilboa, even shouted a marriage proposal towards Gaza in the hope that she might somehow hear.
Daniela Tinasili!
Her mother, Oli Gilboa, says Daniela was moved frequently from underground tunnels to homes hidden from view. They watched the release of the latest three male hostages at the weekend and cried together. Eli Sharabi, one of those who appeared emaciated, is their cousin.
She told me, "Mommy, if I were released 2 months ago, I probably looked like them." She lost a lot of her weight through the captivity. In the last 2 months, they got a lot of food so they can gain weight.
These are among the first interviews with close family members since the hostages have been released, and their parents say full details of what happened to them are still emerging. There are things they can't say, fearful that it may put the 76 hostages still held in Gaza at risk.
She's saying that they are playing all the time with their gun and with their hand grenades. It's fighting.
Shlomi Berger's daughter, Agam, is a 19-year-old violinist, among the women who had just started at the base. Her father says she knows her own mind and was shocked by the way women were treated.
There was times that she was threatened, and sometimes they torture other hostages, female hostages, in front of her eyes. It happened in the same room.
Now, finally home, all the families are calling for the remaining hostages to be urgently released and for answers about why their warnings were missed. They say they will join calls for a national inquiry, one they believe is long overdue. On her return home, Daniela reminded her mum of a stark warning she made just before October 7th.
She told me, "Mommy, when I'm going back to the army, there's going to be war. In my worst nightmares, I didn't think it's going to be such a war, and of course that my daughter will take an hostage."
Oli Gilboa, the mother of the released hostage Daniela. Ending that report by Alice Cuddy. Along with Hamas's release of hostages has come Israel's release of Palestinian prisoners. Perhaps the most famous Palestinian of the many thousands detained is Marwan Barghouti, a man long tipped as a potential future Palestinian leader. Barghouti has served more than two decades in an Israeli jail for murders committed during the Second Intifada, or uprising, during which he emerged as a leading figure and one commanding broad support. His son, Arab Barghouti, is an activist in Ramallah in the West Bank, and he's been speaking to my colleague James Kamarasamy. How should a new political leadership for the Palestinians be decided?
We need to give the Palestinian people, and no other than the Palestinian people, the choice to choose our leadership. It's been almost two decades since we had our last elections. If you're a Palestinian and you're 35 years old or under, which is 70% of the Palestinian people, you have never voted before, let alone getting elected or getting into the parliament or something like that.
Is there a hunger for elections?
There is a hunger, a big hunger for elections and for unity. I think a unified Palestinian people contributes greatly into the future of peace. We do need one umbrella that holds all Palestinian factions under it, that represents the whole of the Palestinian people as well. And we have young people who are very qualified to be in the political scene, that we have never been able to get our voices heard.
Where does Hamas fit in?
I think that Hamas is a political party like any other party. I hope to see a unified Palestinian people, which includes all Palestinian factions, with no exceptions.
So Hamas could be part of the group of parties who rule the Gaza Strip still?
I think it's only the right of the Palestinian people to choose our leadership. Enough with Western governments to come and tell us who we can vote for and who we can't vote for, who we can label a terrorist and who we can label a good guy. They're not qualified to do that.
So your father himself, he's still in prison. You don't know whether he's likely to be released under this ceasefire deal. Is that correct?
We're not sure and we're not certain, but we're very positive and optimistic that he will be part of any future deal, along with all Palestinian political prisoners.
Your father has long been spoken about as a potential leader of the Palestinians. Is that still how you see it? Is it how he sees it?
It's not how I see it or even he sees it. I think it has to do with what the Palestinian people want. And I think that it's not a coincidence that he was leading the polls for more than 20 years. The most important question now is, why is he still the most popular leader in Palestine? He's someone who is a unifying figure. His political vision aligns perfectly with the international community, which is the vision that says that he supports the two-state solution, supports any political solution that contributes into the Palestinian freedom. He's a leader who's known for his anti-corruption policies. He's someone who's willing to sacrifice personally for the cause. And that's the type of leader that the Palestinian people look for.
Is he a leader, though, that the Israelis could work with? He has been in prison. He was found guilty of leading the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a military group. He's always denied that in attacks that killed five people. But given that history, do you think that the Israelis would work with him?
It depends on what the Israelis want. If the Israelis want a long-term peace and coexistence with the Palestinian people, I think that they have a perfect partner for peace. Because you need to remember that my father is someone who has a long experience in negotiating with the Israelis to sustain the peace process back in the 90s. It was only because the Israelis violated the Oslo Accords that he supported the Second Intifada. And he's someone who supports the Palestinian struggle. And not only him, even the international law says clearly that any occupied people have the right to resist their occupier.
And that was Arab Barghouti, son of Marwan Barghouti, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, Palestinian prisoners currently held by Israel. He was speaking to James Kamara-Sami. Welcome back to NewsHour. The drug semaglutide is perhaps the medication of the last few years, marketed as Ozempic or Wegovy. It was developed to treat type 2 diabetes, but more recently it's had huge success helping people lose weight, essentially by controlling appetite. Anecdotally, some users have said that it's also helped curb their cravings for alcohol. Well, now that's been tested in a clinical trial, albeit a very small one, of 48 adults in the United States. Dr. Kara Klein is assistant professor in the medicine department of the University of North Carolina and lead researcher. She's been telling James Menendez what her team found.
We looked at people who described themselves as heavy alcohol users or heavy drinkers, and we randomized them to semaglutide or placebo and then measured how much alcohol they drank, both in a laboratory setting as well as what they reported. And we found that those that were randomized to semaglutide drank less alcohol, both during laboratory assessments, and then they had less heavy drinking days, and they also described less alcohol craving.
It was quite a small study, wasn't it?
Although it's incredibly exciting and very promising, this is a small study and it's preliminary, and we really need longer and larger clinical trials to determine the safety and efficacy in this setting.
And is the thinking that whatever it is in our bodies that controls our appetite also, I mean, that appetite doesn't just apply to food, it can also apply to things like alcohol?
Yeah, we think that these agents, in terms of treating alcohol use and potentially substance use, probably works in the brain, but the other mechanisms may also play a role, the things that induce satiety, the mechanisms by which these agents work in this indication or may work in this indication need to be determined.
In terms of treating type 2 diabetes, I mean, it's been hugely successful, hasn't it?
I am an endocrinologist. I treat people living with diabetes and I treat weight management. And these agents have really revolutionized the way that we treat diabetes. They are just, I can't even describe how amazing they are for people living with these conditions. And they have important cardiovascular disease benefits. They improve many, many metabolic profiles. So they really are amazing agents for those diseases. And we're just beginning to understand how they may impact other disease.
And I should say, yeah, your trial wasn't sponsored by the makers of semaglutide. It was the National Institute for Health. So what happens next? What bigger trials? And then one day, this could be something that doctors prescribe to those who have problems with alcohol abuse.
You know, we are planning and we're hoping that there will be larger, longer trials with a variety of agents, not just semaglutide, but a variety of agents that are emerging and already available. So yes, I do hope and expect that there will be longer trials, larger trials with a variety of agents. And I think that that is very exciting because these have a wide reach. Treatments for alcohol use disorder aren't penetrating as well as they should be. And these drugs, you know, the incretin therapies, the medicines like Ozempic, people are prescribing them readily, and so we have a good shot of reaching a lot of people.
And that was Professor Clara Klein from the University of North Carolina. She was speaking to my colleague, James Menendez. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London with me, Tim Franks. And back to our main story now, the apparent rift between Europe and the US over how to end the war in Ukraine following President Trump's announcement that he wants to start peace talks with Vladimir Putin as soon as possible. Speaking within the last couple of hours, President Trump confirmed that he couldn't see a path to NATO membership for Ukraine.
I don't see any way that a country in Russia's position could allow them, just in their position, could allow them to join NATO. I don't see that happening. And long before President Putin, Russia was very strong on the fact that I believe that's the reason the war started, because Biden went out and said that they could join NATO, and he shouldn't have said that. As soon as he said that, I said, you know what? You're going to have a war now, and I was right about that.
Donald Trump speaking just before we came on air. Dan Reiter is a professor of political sciences at Emory University in the United States. He's the author of the book How Wars End, and last year wrote an opinion piece that was headlined, Ending the War in Ukraine Requires Something for Everyone to Hate. Is that how it's still looking to him?
That is my hope, in the sense that I certainly hope that Moscow is required to make some concessions which it views to be painful. Evacuation of at least all of the Donbas region in Ukraine, if not evacuation of Crimea as well. So my hope is that Russia feels some pain as well as Ukraine.
But I mean, that's simply not going to happen, is it? I mean, even I think Ukraine would acknowledge that it's in any possible medium-term peace deal. I mean, the sense that Ukraine can return to pre-2014 territory that it controls is not going to be a starter, and you know current U.S. administration has said that in terms.
Well, remember that in 2014 Ukraine did control the Donbas region, if not Crimea. So one can imagine some kind of arrangement where, you know, Russia retains de facto control of Crimea, but Ukraine reacquires control of Donbas region.
So you've talked about what possible concessions Russia might make. What about Ukraine?
For me, I think that for Kyiv to promise not to join NATO is probably something which they should do, in part because Kyiv joining NATO is politically off the table, because that requires the unanimous consent of all NATO members, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon. They can offer other concessions, like committing to restore the flow of water into Crimea, which they severed in 2014. In exchange for those concessions, Ukraine could make demands, such as not have any limits on its military or not having limits on other kinds of security ties with NATO, and the reacquisition of Donbas territory. Remember also that Ukraine currently possesses some Russian territory, and a concession they could make is the retreat from that territory. So I think there are the contours for deals which might be more acceptable to Ukraine than is currently being portrayed in the media.
In terms of possible policing of any potential peace deal, U.S. Defense Secretary has said there will be no U.S. boots on the ground. Do you think that it is feasible to think of a strong European peacekeeping presence in some capacity?
My sense is that there is not an appetite amongst European states to deploy troops in any kind of mission to Ukraine. So I think that in terms of enforcing a deal, it'll probably have to come without the deployment of international troops. And of course, a UN mission is off the table because, you know, Russia has veto power in the UN Security Council and would probably veto any UN peacekeeping mission that might be sent to Ukraine.
Do you see this moment, as many people have been saying, as a recasting of the post-World War II security framework?
I think there is that opportunity. I think that is one road we could go down.
It's interesting, forgive me for interrupting, but it is interesting that you use the word opportunity because, you know, there are also a lot of people who have got their heads in their hands over this. I mean, certainly in Europe, who are saying this is very dangerous.
It is dangerous, but I think I am more optimistic than the most pessimistic in the sense that the future is not yet written. I mean, what I would say is that it's important to take statements from the Trump White House with a grain of salt. We know from his first presidency, he made a variety of very inflammatory statements about a variety of policy issues, which he never ended up following through on. For example, you know, withdrawing commitment to NATO, withdrawing troops from South Korea, you know, and so forth. And so that doesn't mean that will never happen. But it's important to understand that there's a lot of bluster coming from the White House on these foreign policy issues. I think that Trump probably sees an opportunity to improve relations with Russia, but I don't necessarily think he sees this as a moment to fundamentally disengage America from the security structure of NATO and Western Europe. So I think we need to bide our time rather than assume that the worst will necessarily occur.
And that was Dan Reiser speaking to me from the US. One of the consequences of that full-scale Russian invasion 3 years ago was that millions of people in Ukraine were forced to leave their homes. Many headed to bordering countries while others moved to places within Ukraine that were considered safer, such as Kyiv and the West. But some of those internally displaced people are now choosing to go back to their homes in more dangerous areas, including to Kramatorsk, just 20 kilometres from the front line. The BBC's Mariana Matvejchuk has met some of them.
The explosions that accompany Vita and her dogs on their walk are a reminder that war is close by. Vita lives in Kramatorsk, in eastern Ukraine, just 20 kilometers from the front line. She left 2 months after the start of the full-scale invasion, escaping just days before Russian rockets hit the city's train station. But now she is back and trying to recover some semblance of her former life. Vita's pet grooming salon is her pride and joy. As she comforts her first client of the day, a Yorkshire Terrier, she tells me how a missile landed close by and almost destroyed her business. But still, she wants to stay.
I returned to Kramatorsk because this is my home. I was born here. My parents were born here, and my grandparents lived here all their lives. Besides having a home, my work is here. I created it myself.
Vita couldn't settle in Kyiv, the city she escaped to. She found herself in a one-bedroom apartment with her daughter and 4 dogs. She says the financial help from the government was insufficient. And with no social connections to support her, she had no choice but to return to Kramatorsk. I've come to meet Andriy, a priest, who also chose to come back to Kramatorsk, despite the dangers. He's pointing out damage to his residential area. A huge hole in an apartment block shows where a glide bomb made impact. 10 people were injured, including 2 children. As a Protestant priest, Andrei would be targeted by Russians. In 2014, during the war in the east of Ukraine, he found himself on a Russian watch list. But he is willing to take the risk to stay and serve his local community, providing the kind of support Vita was missing in Kyiv.
People come here to receive psychological support. It's not only members of this church that visit. People from the whole area come because humanitarian aid has been distributed here for quite a long time. Children and young people spend time here too. They need attention because almost nothing is working in the city now. Public events are prohibited because it is dangerous to gather.
3/4 of Kramatorsk's population left when the full-scale invasion began. Less than 1/4 have since returned. Authorities in the region are trying to discourage more people from coming back while evacuating towns and villages where fighting is happening.
Mariana Matvejchuk reporting from Kramatorsk. A car has been driven into a trade union rally in the German city of Munich, injuring at least 28 people, some seriously. Police say the driver was a 24-year-old Afghan asylum seeker. He was overpowered by emergency services who were on duty for the rally. The authorities haven't ruled out the possibility that the incident was motivated by extremism. All this just days before Germany holds a general election in which immigration is already a big issue. Our correspondent Jessica Parker told me more from Munich.
What we know happened so far is that, as you mentioned, there was a trade union rally earlier on today, really very near the centre of Munich, where I am, and they were going through the streets. There was a sort of police vehicle marshal, and a vehicle overtook that car, police have said, and then rammed into the crowd. Now, this is a crowd of people who included, we're led to believe, potentially nursery workers, hospital staff, but also children. There were some distressing images afterwards, after the attack, of a pram, a buggy, a child's buggy overturned in the road. And then a suspect was arrested at the scene, a 24-year-old Afghan national, an asylum seeker who's been named by German media as Farhad N. Now, he is in custody. Meanwhile, at least 28 people injured being treated following what has been described by authorities as a suspected attack.
And in terms of this suspect, this 24-year-old Afghan asylum seeker, the police had to say anything about him, about, you know, whether he was known to them, for example?
So there were some initial reports, yes, that he was known to the police for alleged drug and theft offences. I've just seen a report in German media, though, that suggests that actually that wasn't quite correct, that he may have been known as a witness. So this seems a little bit unclear at the moment. But he is certainly somebody now, of course, who, as I say, is in custody, and they've said they are looking at potential extremist indications, or they can't rule out extremism or extremist links.
Right. And of course, I mean, this comes in the context of next week's elections, where immigration is a big issue.
It really is a big issue. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of voters over the last week in Germany. It comes up a lot. There has been a string of attacks by where the suspects have been asylum seekers over the last year. People might remember Aschaffenburg, Magdeburg, Solingen. So this has really heightened what was already, frankly, a pretty fraught debate. And I think for parties like the Conservative CDU, who are top of the polls, the party that's been leading the coalition government that collapsed, the SPD, they've been trying to toughen up their language on this, looking over their shoulder, really, because they also know that this is really the key issue, the signature issue for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, which has continually showed really strong polling, second nationally, and is expected to do very well next week.
And next week we'll be hearing much more from our colleague James Kamarasamy, who will be reporting on those German elections. That was Jessica Parker speaking to me from Munich. This is News Hour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC, and we're going to head back to Germany now because, as I mentioned earlier, the issue of immigration is weighing heavily for many voters ahead of the general election later this month. And a series of attacks blamed on asylum seekers, like the one today in Munich, has only added to that sense, which in turn seems to be helping the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD. Opinion polls suggest that the party will win about 20% of the votes, a huge increase on the last election. AfD supporters now come from a much more diverse mix of backgrounds, as our Europe editor Katja Adler has been finding out.
Alice Weidel. The crowd waving their German flags, Alice for Germany, Alice, 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 they're shouting, like a rock star, even though she's dressed, as always, like a banker, which she once was.
The AfD ist die Partei, die dieses Land wieder stark und stolz machen will.
This is the party that will make Germany proud and strong, she said.
Wir wollen, dass eure Kinder und eure Enkelkinder eine Zukunft haben.
She says, we're going to make sure, we in the AfD are going to make sure that your children and your grandchildren live in a safe country. So we have tried really hard to get an interview now with Alice Weidel. I mean, really hard, including at this event. And we have been told that she's far too busy to talk to us. But the crowd here had been really interesting because the stereotypical image of an AfD voter is an older, angry white man from East Germany. We're in the West, and there are a lot of young women here, old women as well as younger men. I'm curious to ask some people why they felt it important to be here today. You're a young woman.
Yes.
What interests you in the AfD program?
Germany will be better than now. This is my hope. Familien sind nicht geschützt, man kann nicht mehr auf die Straße gehen.
You can't go out at night on the streets anymore. Migration needs to be more controlled.
Klar definiert sein.
Why are you here today?
Because I'm interested in seeing Alice Weidel and Tino Chrupalla. I never see them live, just in internet or YouTube.
We hear a lot about the AfD, that it has a very big social media presence. What is it that they do that's attractive for young people in social media?
I think they speak about the problems for the young people. A lot of young people have problems with immigrants and criminality.
Ich bin Journalistin von der BBC, also von britischen Radio.
Nee, danke. Nein. Auch Lügenpresse.
Lügenpresse, okay. I've just been dismissed as lying press by a woman I approached. Now, that's a phrase that dates back to Nazi times. I don't know if she is aware of that. I mean, the AfD has long felt shunned and resentful towards mainstream media. But I have to say, most supporters here have been really open with me today. And that is a sign the party is feeling a lot more confident. And that has to do with the majority of German voters being really preoccupied with core AfD themes, security and migration. I've now travelled to the southern German university town of Mannheim. I'm in the charming cobblestone main square of the old town, but what I'm looking at here is an informal memorial. Cards and flowers left here for a young policeman stabbed to death a few months ago by an Afghan asylum seeker. Other passers-by here were wounded as well, and that was just one of a string of attacks involving migrants in Germany over the past 10 months. The AfD are leafleting here today in Mannheim ahead of elections. Most people I'm speaking to here say security and migration are the things they're most worried about.
My name is Dominic, and I'm a father of four. I'm thinking about voting AfD because of the security situation in Germany. So many attacks in recent months. The AfD says it will control migration. Some people say the AfD is a Nazi party. But every party has some rotten apples in its ranks. I think maybe give them a chance to govern. Until then, we won't know who they really are.
If I'm out at night, policemen scold me. What are you doing out this late, old lady? You can't take safety for granted here anymore, you know. I am most interested in the AfD's economic and security policies.
Yeah, but this is important because we are always, the people are saying, well, we are racist. This is nonsense. This is garbage.
Heinrich Koch is here. He's a local AfD politician, and he insists the AfD is open to everyone, as long as they're law-abiding.
We had on our list German Sintis. And we're having people from Turkish migration, from Iran, from Hungary, from Poland, from Romania and so on.
So car has just driven past this AfD stand shouting, Nazis raus, Nazis get out. They've driven into the parking lot, so I'm going to see if I can catch up with them. So you drove past?
Yeah.
And shouted. What did you shout?
We shouted Nazis out, so we don't want Nazis here.
I've been talking to this about them today. I mean, they say, we're not Nazis. We have no Nazis in our party. We're not extremists.
If you work in a party that openly discriminates people and is openly against democracy, then you're a part of this movement and then you are a Nazi. I'm sorry. With our backstory in Germany, you cannot say something like that.
The two girls we were just talking to who accused the AfD of being Nazis, they're now engaging with them in a heated debate. This is so not German. I cannot tell you. I have covered politics in this country for years and years and years. Elections in this country are known to be dull, boring and predictable most of the time.
AfD!
Remember the AfD rally with their Chancellor candidate Alice Weidel that started this report? While she addressed hundreds of supporters inside Heidenheim Concert Hall, this anti-AfD demonstration was going on outside, close by. Not too close. German police made sure of that to avoid clashes. Emotions are running high here. You can hear that. Voters for and these against the AfD each believe their country is in danger from the other. Now, larger political parties have pledged to exclude the AfD from any new government, but in a bid to boost their popularity, especially the conservative CDU, is aping AfD rhetoric on migration and security. And that is a win for the AfD, whatever happens next here.
And that was our Europe editor, Katia Adler, reporting from Germany ahead of next week's elections. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.